This week, Josh Lefkowitz and Chris Camacho join us from Flashpoint. In our startup news for this week, how someone else, not me, burned through $10 million so that you don't have to. Foolish and focused, the risk not taken, promising equity versus issuing equity. Five technologies your business should adopt right now. Deal breakers and cutting through machine learning hype. All that and more on this edition of Startup Security Weekly. This is a Security Weekly production.
I need it from the top. Brought to you by LogRhythm's Netmon Freemium delivers real-time network visibility to quickly identify emerging threats in your IT environment. Netmon Freemium is a free commercial-grade network forensics and traffic analytics solution. You can use Netmon Freemium's powerful capabilities to search against all of observed network traffic, identify abnormal traffic patterns and application usage, and quickly analyze full packet captures. Take the first step towards real-time network visibility. Visit logrhythm.com/freemium to learn more and download it today.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 19 of Startup Security Weekly. That's right, there's been 19 episodes. This is Friday, December 9th. I'm your host, Paul Asadorian, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island. The roof-raising mofo himself, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo, is on the lines from the beach. It looks like sunny South Carolina.
Yeah, it's cold though. We got that cold front coming across, and it's like cold enough that we actually had to put a vest on, and we have to turn up the heat and everything else. But you know what's keeping me warm is prepping for our dance off. I told the kids about it. They can't wait. And now people are like, it's gonna be on the internet, so we're gonna have to do something, my friend.
You're prepping for what?
Our dance off.
Everyone. I'm not planning anything for Paul Security Weekly episode 500, but apparently the rest of the Security Weekly crew is all coming here like sometime in February, like February 9th or something like that. So if you can make that work, Michael.
Maybe I'll have to try to make that work, yeah.
I like I said, I'm not planning anything, but there's always booze here and we can all just sit around and drink and record podcasts because that's kind of what we do. So, and I certainly could have used a drink before my intro. It wasn't the smoothest one. Ever.
They don't always have to be smooth. I'm excited though, because today we're going to talk. This is the substance that we're enjoying getting into. We're going to talk about pivots. We're going to talk about traction. Those are two things that are important when you're in a startup, and that's what our guests are going to bring today.
Yeah, and then Michael, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guests and kick off our feature interview for this episode?
Yeah, sure. So we've got Josh Lefkowitz and we've got Chris Camacho, and they're both part of Flashpoint. I had a chance to talk to them a couple weeks ago, and what really caught my attention, especially for our program, was we were talking about threat intel and you know what I'll call their pivot. We'll see how they handle it and how they think about it. But it's not just calling it threat intel; it's talking about business risk intelligence. And it connected with me. I was like, oh, I really like that. I like the way you did that. So naturally, I'm like, wait, how did you figure that out? How did you start to pivot? And so we had a really good, excited conversation about it. And I wanted to see if they could come on and join us, and so they did. So we've got Josh and Chris with us. And what's also cool is that Chris joined, but was an early adopter of the technology and really got to understand the company before he joined it. So we can talk about traction. So there's so much that we can talk about, from founding to getting through to getting your initial traction to making your pivot in what seems like exciting, especially in a field that's new, but also a little crowded and a little bit confusing. So Josh, Chris, welcome to Startup Security Weekly.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
No, it's our pleasure. All right. So let's start with Josh. How did you get started with this? Like what's the genesis of Flashpoint? How did you pick out the name? What was it like in the early days of setting this up?
Yeah, absolutely. So we founded Flashpoint back in 2010. My co-founder, Evan Coleman, and I had known each other dating back to our first jobs out of college in the early 2000s. We both grew up as intelligence analysts, really focused on the counterterrorism portfolio, working hand in hand with federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys across the country, particularly when there was an investigation or prosecution that had an online component. And throughout the 2000s, as the internet became an even more critical component of terrorist fundraising, propaganda, recruitment, these individuals, these networks were operating in the underbelly of the internet, password-protected forums primarily. And as analysts, we experienced tremendous pain on a very manual level, trying to keep an eye on these various illicit actor communities. There were no search engines that enabled you to look across forums. There were tremendous operational security restrictions and requirements that made even a basic keyword search on a search engine that a forum would make available extremely challenging. And so we looked at ways that you could bring technology to bear to provide efficiencies and really make analysts more effective as they were monitoring the underbelly of the internet. We saw a range of solution providers that had emerged that were really only focused on the open web, commercial social media like Twitter and Facebook, comment sections on the New York Times, etc. But from our perspective, if you really wanted to look into the internet to understand risk and threat, there needed to be a far more dedicated focus on the deep and dark web. And that was what, you know, really the brainchild of Flashpoint's origins trace back to.
I have a question that I think is burning on a lot of people's minds, and a question that I get frequently when I consult with organizations, and that is, how is what Flashpoint does and this kind of I don't want to call it threat intelligence, but my question is, how do you differentiate yourself from threat intelligence? I feel like it's kind of like the market has gone in two different, slightly different directions. And I'm sure you get this question a lot. So I'm curious to hear your answer.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it was that question that kept emerging as we were having conversations with a range of buyers, Chris included, when he was wearing his Bank of America hat, that led us to take a step back and look objectively at what we were doing versus the market. And when you say cyber threat intelligence in the context of the market, the predominant reaction is that you are a feed provider, that you are essentially providing malicious hashes, malicious IP addresses, IOCs in its simplest conception. And when we looked at the engagement that we were having with our customers across the Fortune 500, what we were really doing was helping them make more effective and efficient decisions. And it was not unique to the cybersecurity team. We were engaging with fraud teams, with insider threat teams, with physical and executive protection teams. And so in that way, that really was the origin of this term that we've developed around business risk intelligence, with the recognition that by really understanding our customers' requirements, their priority intelligence requirements, that essentially positions us as an extension of their team. While there inevitably will be some machine-to-machine communication through an API, that is not the bulk of the value proposition that we bring to our customers. It's helping them navigate really complex, really complicated problems and driving to a more effective decision.
I like it. Sorry, Michael. Continue.
No, that's good. But so, and that set up the question well. So You have a pretty good focus. So, Chris, is this something that you sought out when you were in the enterprise, or did Flashpoint come to you and you were like, that's interesting? Like, tell me more about, like, let's talk about some of that traction. And I'm really kind of curious how that worked on both sides. Like, what's it like, you know, Josh, when you were starting getting that traction at a big enterprise? But Chris, let's start with you. So you're at the big enterprise. They're a startup. How did you, and you weren't at a small company, you're at a huge company. How did you get that? How did you get started with them? How did you find them? Did you find them? Did they find you? Take us through some of your perspective on that.
Yeah, so thanks. I actually got word about Flashpoint through a peer of mine in a different financial institution, and a quick introduction. I believe my peer was also one of the larger financial institutions and customer number two of Flashpoint. In turn, we became customer number three of Flashpoint. So we were early adopters because I believed in the mission that they were doing. I loved the human intelligence aspect of things. We already had a whole bunch of providers and feeds that Josh was talking about that were providing us contextual indicators or malware samples. But our team was just overwhelmed with information. A lot of it was repetitive or not useful to us or had no context. So it was not actionable. What Flashpoint provided was actionable information or information that specifically targeted the bank or the financial sector. And it was really early warnings that would let us prepare or let any enterprise prepare for an imminent threat. And that was what was really important. I like the what Josh was talking about, an extension of the team. I really considered Flashpoint to be an extension of our team. And then on the flip side now, I'm seeing that we've become an extension of many of our customers' teams. Many customers talk about forming this quote-unquote partnership with the vendor. I've seen it on the flip side when they talk to me about it, and it doesn't happen. We just are a customer, and once a year they come along and say, it's time for renewal. Are you happy? If we're happy, yeah. We renew. If we're not, we don't, right? But at Flashpoint, we're really trying to partner with the customer either on-site through ongoing calls, you know, analyst-to-analyst exchange, just different formats that keeps us engaged into their PIRs or the requirements or things that change for them so that we are always on top of things.
All right, so let's go back then. So if you're customer number three, but you're working at a big bank, was there already a defined need for this? Because the two things that you said that I thought were interesting was that, I mean, it seems like there was an immediate fit for what they had, but they also, you guys had a respected peer, a colleague, a friend in the industry that was already a customer of theirs. And so one of the things we always talk about is that word of mouth and those testimonials are really important. Somebody calls up and says, hey, Chris, you've got to check this out. That probably puts them on your radar faster. But when you carried that internally and said, hey, I need a check to go right to these guys. We want what they do. Was that a long process or was there already a defined need and Flashpoint was able to fill that hole?
I would say that Flashpoint was patient to help us define the need. One of the areas that we were transforming our team was to be more of a fusion center, like get more involved in fraud, get more involved in physical security, get more involved in third-party risk, in supply chain. And Flashpoint was providing a lot of the information in different areas that we just weren't used to. So while we were trying to build the business case of bringing on Flashpoint on board, Flashpoint, like I mentioned earlier, really partnered with us to, you know, work with us as we were establishing the business case to develop the program into other areas that we were expanding on. So it was actually a quick POC, and then from there, a quick turnaround to become a customer because they showed us the justification that allocated the funding that needed to bring them on.
So Josh, from your perspective, it sounds like too, as you guys work to be extensions of teams and such, was it a focus early on then to go find did you say, okay, we're going to go target banks, we're going to target big banks, we're going to prove that this works, and that's going to make it easier for other people to get on with us? Or was it just more of that's how it happened and you ran with it?
So it was definitely more of the former than the latter. Keep in mind this was back in, even though we founded the company in 2010, we really didn't dip our toe in the commercial customer base until 2013. And in 2013, intelligence programs on the cyber side within Fortune 500 companies were still very much emergent. Obviously, Chris was leading one of the most mature and well-defined. But as you looked across sectors, the financial services sector was and still is really, the forefather, if you will, of what it means to do intelligence in the commercial realm. We had the benefit of other vendors coming before us, like iSight, who'd really helped define what it means to have a vendor relationship with a Fortune 500 company doing intelligence in the corporate realm. This was also around the time that the banks were under attack by the Izzedine Al-Qassam cyber fighters, experiencing debilitating DDoS attacks that were causing a lot of concern internally as well as within the U.S. government. So there was certainly a macro catalyst that facilitated them to reach out beyond their existing vendor relationships and be open to conversations with others who may be able to help. And because Chris and some of our early customers were such thought leaders in the industry and such influencers, they were tremendously helpful in terms of being a referral source. And, you know, for the majority of our first years without a sales team to speak of, it was our customers who were our most helpful marketing source. They were, you know, they would always get together at conferences like the FSISAC. They would talk about who they were working with. This is a very insular and very interconnected community, and your reputation, your ability to add value travels very quickly, or lack thereof. And so we were very fortunate to have folks like Chris, who were early adopters and who had such a ability to be an influencer in the community.
All right, so let's now talk about what at least I'm calling the pivot. Now, I may be incorrect by saying, and Paul already asked about the threat intel side of things, but when I talked to you guys and you introduced the concept of business risk intelligence, I really liked it. It made sense to me. Talk us through some of the conscious effort to get to that. Was it born of realizing that what you were doing was bigger and you're refining the message? Was that message given to you by your customers? Or was it kind of like frustration of explaining how you were not really just threat intel and how, like, take us through that, because I think a lot of people when they're in a startup phase don't always recognize the pivot, and you guys did. So I'm curious kind of like what led up to it, and then, you know, tell us a little about how that's helping you or what you're seeing from it so far.
Chris, you want to take the first crack at that?
Sure. So one of the benefits I had before coming in was having been a customer and been at a large enterprise and having talked to so many vendors, I came in and met with the management team at Flashpoint and gave them my perception of what threat intelligence currently means in the market. And it really was a crowded space. Different people had different perceptions and ideas and definitions of threat intelligence. Gartner had, you know, all these different companies lumped into threat intelligence. Some made sense, some didn't. So we discussed, you know, how could we really be impactful to the clients as they're really building fusion centers, like we talked about earlier, whether it's fraud, executive protection, supply chain, overall risk. And we came up with this concept of business risk intelligence, something that would let us continue working with the cyber teams, but at the same time, go and talk to all these other teams at an enterprise and show them value of solutions like ours. It's actually been really successful. The customers that we're talking to all love the concept of business risk intelligence because in some capacity, they're all trying to measure risk, right? And if they're trying to measure risk and we're applying business risk intelligence to them and giving them this proactive warnings and different information that they're just not used to from an adversarial aspect, that's been what's resonating with the customers. So I think the pivot came to get us away from this crowded market of threat intelligence. Now, Gartner hasn't adopted business risk intelligence. We're working with Gartner closely in Forrester because, you know, a lot of people just follow whatever Gartner says in a magic quadrant. But at the same time, that's okay. We really want to make this a market, help shape the market, and then I'm sure some of these our peers in the industry will follow along because we're starting to hear some buzz from some competitors around risk now, which is a new pivot for them. So while we made an early attempt to pivot, it was because we want to be sticky and resonate with an enterprise besides just one team.
So Josh, what was it like for you? So Chris came in, he's got industry experience, he's recognized for his leadership in it, he's now part of your team, and he's saying, guys, listen, I think there's a bigger play here. Did you look at that instantly and you're like, yeah, let's run with it? Or were you like, well, hold on though, what we're doing is working, it's good, I'm not sure. How did you process and handle that from your perspective?
So at Flashpoint, we definitely have a very collaborative and rigorous process when we make what I would characterize as material decisions, where we want to get everyone around the table, whiteboard it out, and think about the implications, risks, opportunity costs of anything that we're doing. And so, Chris brought this to the table, and I'd say it took a series of discussions over a course of about 2 months where we really worked out what exactly the term should be, what did it actually mean, what implications would there be, and, you know, what may we not be thinking about. We have the benefit here at Flashpoint of a number of team members that have been on the other side, not just Chris, but others who helped build and lead the teams at Hewlett-Packard, at FIS Global. Our Intel team is now led by Tom Hoffman, who led the Intel team at PNC. So they've been on the other side. They've been within organizations that are trying to work collaboratively in this fusion center type approach. And as we had those conversations, it really did resonate with them. And as we bounced it off of our customer advisory board, which encompasses customers across a number of different sectors, we got great feedback from them. And so, you know, over the course of that decision-making process, that lab environment, we really felt that it more effectively communicated and positioned, in many ways, what we were already doing, because we were already working with many of these teams across our customer set, and the label of cyber threat intelligence, did not effectively capture and position what we were truly doing and the direction that we want to continue to head in 2017 and beyond.
So there's two things there, and one of which maybe is something we can talk about later. But I think it's fascinating that you have been able to build your team from people that have really credible experience, but that they were your clients. I think that's remarkable. I don't see a ton of that, and there's probably a bunch of reasons why. But I want to stay kind of on point with this, though, because I still think it's, when you guys talked to me, it clicked. And the reason is, as we've talked about, threat intel was a crowded space. And when people would call me to brief me on it or pitch me, if I said, okay, what's the problem it solves? It's like, well, it's threat intel. Well, okay, well, how does it work? Where does it fit into the enterprise? And I would get a lot of jargon back. And so it also felt like it was a crowded space where you either knew what you were doing or it was something that everybody kind of talked about, but nobody acted on. Now that you're talking about business risk intelligence, have you found that people say, oh, like you're threat intel, but different? Or does it just completely change the conversation because now you can point to executive protection and you can point to fraud? Like, talk us through what that's been like changing the messaging. Are people, like, how are people responding to it as you're putting it out there?
Go ahead, Chris.
Yep, sure. Let me take that one. So I've had the benefit of being on customer on-sites and prospect on-sites and talking to, you know, obviously prospective customers. The message has been sticking. So I can go in there and say, hey, you know, this is Flashpoint. This is what we're doing around business risk intelligence. And it immediately sticks. And the reason is, in addition to having the traditional threat intelligence team, we're asking, can you bring in some of these other teams with this fusion-like concept that you already mentioned there? If it's not sticking with the threat intel team because they think they have a solution already, or they think they have someone that's an expert there, it's sticking with the executive protection team and the various other teams. So the benefits are that our solution can go with a wide variety of teams within an enterprise. We're having a lot of meetings out west these days where it's not even the cyber threat traditional teams that we'd expect them to have. It's other teams. And we're getting the benefits of those meetings because of our messaging, right? Our whole marketing has shifted. Our solutions are different. The information that we have is more specific to their needs. So it lets us get into opportunities that we otherwise wouldn't have using this concept of BRI.
Yeah, I mean, I like it. It sounds like a differentiator to me. And that's kind of the stuff that I was excited about. I mean, Paul and I talk a lot about listening to your clients and learning from their language and wrapping it into it. And it's, you know, like I said, I think it's novel in a positive way that, Josh, you've been able to build your team by listening to your clients and taking people along with you. And now you're changing that type of a conversation as it goes forward. All right. So Paul, one of the questions that you always ask, but I'm going to ask it this time, how do you decide, Josh, early on, what features to include and not to include? I mean, so like when you started, you had a couple big customers. They probably had, did they all have the same needs or did they have different needs? And how did you decide what do you focus on versus what do you wait for later versus what do you just say, I'm sorry, we can't do it? How do you handle that?
That's a great question. And I think, it speaks to a broader challenge that startups face, which is...
Josh froze in excitement.
Oh. Hello.
Oh, you're there, Josh. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry about that, Chris. One of the challenges that startups face at their most fundamental core is finite resources, finite time, and finite money. So, and it's very easy to get your head on a swivel and try to do everything, be all things to all people. And that's usually one of the most frequent reasons that, startups fall short. So for us, it was absolutely imperative for us when we were thinking about core features to focus on in our early days when we were extraordinarily lean and mean, and you know, getting revenue in the door was critical. We didn't raise venture until 2015, so 5 years after we founded. We needed to really have our pulse on what would move the needle from a deal closing perspective. The way that we did this was actually start with the U.S. government and allied governments as our first customer base between 2010 and 2013. We took the perspective that if particular national security-focused agencies had pain points and we could deliver product that solved those, that was a great leading indicator that Fortune 500 companies had the exact same problem set. And so by having those conversations in the early days between 2010 and 2013, that enabled us to really hone in on some very clear problem sets that guided our product development heading into the commercial market. The other component of this, because our team really does blend a fusion of analysts with deep subject matter expertise with technologists, so developers who are sitting side by side, we had the benefit of really having a very savvy internal testing bed to get very quick feedback on. We were able to show them tools or data or features and say, does this really help you? Or is this just, you know, pomp and circumstance with a slick GUI that actually doesn't help you make better decisions or have more rigorous analysis? And in that way, particularly in that environment where pretty much every solution was pulling down Facebook and Twitter and trying to map to threat and risk on the internet, you know, we were focused on staying away from that, to really focus on the corners in the internet that mattered, do that with a laser-like focus, with a recognition that it was far less about big data, far more about smart data, and, you know, essentially look at product features and data collection through this hedgehog lens of, you know, time is your most precious element when you're a startup. You need to get a minimally viable product out to the market, get customers who are referenceable, and then continue to iterate from there based on having your ear to the ground and really listening to your customers.
How do you deal with this problem that most of us face in security? And that is, if you have a really good product and you get a potential customer and you do some kind of test, but you don't find anything. And a lot of us will, I mean, that should be a success, right? I mean, good job. But I'm sure you've run into the situation where you're looking for information specific to that organization and just not coming up with anything. Is that considered success? And how do you deal with that situation?
Chris, you want to take that one?
Yes, happy to. So it depends. Yeah, that can mean success because the company maintains a low profile, which is probably what they wanted. And we have examples of customers like that. They use this more or less for insurance purposes in case for that one day someone does talk about them in the deep and dark web, they want to be alerted. But more importantly, we don't really try to focus on the specific customer. We also try to focus on their sector, right? So if it's a small bank, let's keep them well informed about the financial sector overall and the overall health of the industry in general. So the whole information security landscape. Also, besides just typical deep and dark web threats, maybe they're interested in, you know, how can I protect my network against DDoS? How can I protect my network against destructive malware, right? I have several credentials out there that I don't know how to process. So it's not, even though we may not find a specific hit or alert on their keyword or on their brand, there's other areas that we seem to provide a lot of value on. So that's also part of the business risk intelligence message. It's not, you know, we don't go in there and try to show them a demo and try to come up with something that may be specific to them. There's different use cases that seem to stick with the customers. But I would say that we really focus on the sector specific use cases. And that seems to be relevant to the customers.
Excellent. Michael, do you have more questions?
Well, you know, I'm kind of curious, Josh, you talked about, so you founded in 2010, you started going commercial 2013. What led up to the decision to go seek funding in 2015? Like when you did your first round, what was that like?
Yeah, great, Great question. So I think at that point, we always wanted to wait to go out and fund the business through institutional capital until we were, we had a product that had gone to market, that we had a referenceable customer base that had renewed, and proven a track record of success, and had a much clearer vision of, what we wanted to use that money for, particularly given that in 2013, 2014, we were still very much in learning mode around the requirements and selling process for the corporate market, which is candidly quite different from doing business with the U.S. government and allied partners. So I think that was really what led us to wait. And then what drew us, or what pointed us to actually go out to the market, was that we were having tremendous success. And in 2015, we really felt that by taking on institutional capital, that would provide us with, one, the fuel to really accelerate our growth trajectory, and also to have the opportunity to partner with VCs that had deep-seated security expertise, like our lead from the Series A down in Atlanta, Tech Operators, who built and scaled ISS to a tremendous exit. We're first-time entrepreneurs. We have the humility and perspective to understand that there's a lot that we don't know. And, not only have our venture partners been tremendously helpful, but having that venture financing has enabled us to go out and recruit tremendous talent. Never in a million years did I think that we would have the ability to recruit somebody of Chris's caliber, for example. And raising that round, helped us build the profile and grow the team enable us to do that.
Yeah, well, Josh, and I'm certain that it's not just monetary compensation that you've been able to attract the talent that you have, and certainly I couldn't think of two better people in addition to Chris, with Allison Nixon and Lance James. What recommendations do you have for startups that are looking to attract talent? Because you seem to have done a really good job at that.
No, absolutely. We've been humbled at the caliber of talent that has come to Flashpoint and stayed at Flashpoint. Particularly in industry where, there's an acute talent war each and every day. So, I think one of the draws for folks who have come to Flashpoint is the opportunity to really feel like they're part of something innovative. If you're looking at, 100 startups that are all sucking down Twitter and Facebook, it's hard to differentiate. So to answer your question directly, I think it's giving talent, the sense that they're working on something that matters, that moves the needle, that has a mission, that they can do something cutting edge. Another aspect is building a culture that really empowers individual achievement, but while doing that in a collaborative environment. Building a culture where you feel like there's a career trajectory. That's always a challenge for startups because, it's not like you can move up the proverbial ladder from GS8 to GS9 to GS10 like you can in government land. But, as we've grown, opportunities both for career development as well as individual brand building, if you will, has been important. We want to highlight our people. They're our most precious asset. And so if you look at what we've been doing with our team member profile on our blog, for example, every 2 weeks, where we let our analysts tell their story. And they're just such incredible stories to be told, whether it's Leroy, who speaks 5 languages fluently, or Roman, who just joined us after 21 years at the FBI. I think a lot of folks feel like they can get lost at other companies, here at Flashpoint we've placed a heavy emphasis on letting people shine because they're incredible.
And was that Jennifer's idea? Because that's another great pickup by you guys as well.
It actually was something that was in the works before she joined, but she's been an incredible hire as well. And she was fully on board with the idea before we, as we rolled it out.
Awesome. Awesome. Michael, any closing questions for Josh and Chris?
No, I mean, it's been great. And I really appreciate it because we've been looking forward to having some of these detailed questions. And, one of the things we always tell people is don't take money until you need it. Right, Paul? We've talked about that a number of times. And here you are. You guys have given us that insight and that experience, and that was really cool. I guess one of the questions that we always like to ask is, if somebody else right now, right, so you said you're first-time entrepreneurs, I think you're doing a fantastic job of it, so somebody listening right now, maybe thinking about their side hustle, maybe thinking one day they want to step out on their own. What advice would you give them based on what you've learned over the last 6 years or so?
Sure. Great question. You know, for me, having spent about 15 months at another job before I joined Flashpoint full time in the fall of 2011, you know, this is trite and a bit hackneyed, but you know, one element is there is absolutely no substitute for grinding, being willing to just get down and do whatever it takes to be successful. I think associated with that is, you know, having a humility. I think part of the reason that we were able to build relationships with the giants of industry like Chris and others in our early years was that while we were very confident that we had a differentiated solution that could add a lot of value, we were very measured in the way that we had conversations and really tried to lead with substance and content and true value add. Rather than some of the other approaches that we've seen from earlier stage companies. I can't tell you how many times our customers will forward emails that they've received from vendors where it's essentially an extortionist approach. We have X, so and such information. You know, we'd be happy to share it with you if you sign this contract. And particularly in this industry, and I said this earlier, it is so interconnected. It is so tightly wound that your reputation is your most precious asset. And so by doing the right thing, by leading in a collaborative way, it goes a tremendously long way. You know, so I think those are two aspects that have resonated with us. Another element that I think has really resonated with us, and it's not sexy, and you certainly wouldn't see it, you know, on the first page of a, you know, sort of how to build a business 101 textbook, but process is so incredibly important as you begin to grow a business. How do you build the foundations for growth, laying the tracks for something that's repeatable and scalable? And you make so many different decisions throughout the course of the day. Decisions that you don't necessarily appreciate in the moment have often real implications long beyond what you do. Surround yourself with excellence. Surround yourself with people that can drive better decisions. And in the earliest days of Flashpoint, that was one particular advisor who I'd grown up with who was able to take an arm's length perspective into some of the decisions, because you get so caught up in the tyranny of the tactical, you may not be able to step back and really understand. And that's manifested itself throughout our growth cycle. So those are just a few things that we've learned in the trenches. The last thing I'd say is, go ahead.
So Chris, I want to ask you a question then, because you made that transition. So you're not the founder, but you've gone from huge global enterprise to, hey, I've now got the startup mindset. We can move faster. So insights for you on people making that transition or interested in it, any lessons learned? I know you're newer into it, but anything there that you would share with people looking at this startup mindset or this mentality?
Sure. I bring a different perspective. So I've been pitched by many of these CEOs, a lot of first time CEOs. So my advice is do your homework when you're going to go and pitch to a company like a large financial institution, meaning understand your competitors. Understand your real solution. Will it scale if you're coming after the whales, per se, after the large organizations? Because what's happened a lot of times is, you know, startup happens, they get some funding, they have a solution or they're developing a solution, and they come along to a large enterprise, a Fortune 500, and they think it's, you know, an easy sell, but it's not. These institutions see so many technologies and vendors day in and day out. If they give you the time, that means that they respect what solution you're bringing to them or your team, which is great, but don't waste their time, right? Understand what that financial institution does, what your solution is going to help them, can it actually work, and can you deliver? If you can't answer all those questions, then don't waste their time or your time, because as Josh was saying, this community is incestuous. So one bad review from one organization is going to carry itself across every other organization. And I also completely agree with Josh. The humility, you know, the people aspect of things, the team that you bring together, is all going to be very important for a startup and a CEO and their teams to be successful as they grow.
Well, Josh and Chris, thank you very much for doing this interview on Startup Security Weekly. It was awesome hearing your thoughts and insight. Have a great day, gentlemen. Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. I'm, of course, Paul Asadorian, joined by Michael Santarcangelo. Not wearing your sandals today, huh, Michael?
I'm barefoot, baby. Just not going outside. It is cold.
I like that it's cold and you still don't have shoes. Like, when it's cold here, we wear, like, thick socks and shoes inside because it's still cold.
I just don't like it. And one of my kids is like it. And we're like, my wife is always like, you need to put on your socks. I'm like, no, she's good. She's all right.
It's fine.
It's not going to lose her foot. It's not going to leave.
That's it. So
we're at episode 19. This is awesome.
It is awesome. Man, we got some great stuff planned too. I'm excited.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm getting excited about. You know, it's very meta doing a show about startups, running it like a startup and talking to people and finding out what they're interested in and finding our voices and getting into the rhythm. And it's a blast. I'm thoroughly enjoying this, and I enjoy your friendship and our company and these conversations and the things that result from it. So
I do too. You know, and it's interesting, Michael, not all of the stories, the news articles this week relate back to necessarily the startup, but some of it relate back to Security Weekly and some of the things we're trying to do, which really isn't, as I've said before, not really a start. We're in our 11th year. When we create new shows, certainly, like you said, it's very much a startup mindset. So. So I'm excited to talk about some of the ones that the two of the ones that are focused on risk this week, Michael, really resonate with how I approach some things here and have been thinking about things at Security Weekly. So
let's start there. Let's go. Let's hop in.
I liked your order. Your order was good. So foolish and focused was first. And I love the question. And apparently, this was a company called Bonobos. And they said, do we feel we take enough risk at Bonobos? And I think that's a question that certainly we probably ask it more when we're in a sheer startup, right?
Yep.
But I ask that question in my head all the time, sometimes out loud, you know, are we taking enough risk? And that's just a question that when you're running a business or, you know, when they're starting a new podcast or a new segment, you know, are we taking enough risk in that? How much risk is too much? Is the juice worth the squeeze? In other words, is a constant question that comes up. So,
what I like about that question is, and it's the top highlight in the article. I know a lot of companies that failed due to lack of focus. I can't think of one that failed because they were too focused. And so a lot of the stories for this week had that kind of interplay between the two. So wait, are we taking enough risks or are we focused enough? And that's one of the things that I've been focusing on with Straight Talk is to say, look, you gotta get rid of the stuff that doesn't work and focus on what matters. Mm-hmm. But what this is also helping me remember is, yeah, hold on though, you've got to learn. And he's got a dialogue in there of a conversation he had with somebody else to say, yeah, but look, you did that and it didn't work out for you, but it doesn't make it a mistake. Oh, I mean, there was a lot of value in this one that I really liked. And then his follow-up was the risk not taken. So they're both written by the same person. And I thought that was really just kind of interesting too.
And I think for our audience that you may not have a business that you're running or a startup that you're creating or want to create, you may just be managing, not just, but you're managing your career in this, all of this logic applies. Right. I mean, I think whether you're managing your career or business or a startup, this conversation about risk and how you expand and how much you focus and how you do that over time is really important to consider. And you're probably making those decisions, not really realizing that it relates back to this kind of risk question in this context, but that's really what you're doing. You know, do I take a risk in my career and take a new job in an area? Do I spend a lot of time researching a particular subject and not be able to do some other things that I may have as some of my career goals, and how do I prioritize? It's the same thing. you know, when we're going through some of our shows here, you know, do we, for example, put a lot of effort into something that isn't growing at the rate we want it to grow, or do we scale back and focus? And that's, to me, that's one of the more difficult decisions to make, as you know, in business and in your career.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Again, so I'm going to point to what other people do, the heavy lifting. It's one of the things I like about Medium. Top highlight: if you can't decide what to do, get on the road. You won't find the answer. It'll find you. You know, that's an artful way of saying some of the stuff that we've talked about too, relative to the risk, which is just try it. Right. I mean, navel gazing's nice, but you know, so like, to your point, I find a lot of people get paralyzed. So we either try to do everything and be everything to everybody, or we get so paralyzed that we I'm not sure if that makes sense or not. I don't know. Well, we could do this or we could do this, but what about, yeah. And what I'm kind of learned from this is, no, just go, like, just do it. Like, you know, and I think there's probably some gradients to it, right? So you don't have to throw everything into it. You can test the waters, you can get some experience, and to me, that's actually the key. Like this, you won't find the answer, it'll find you. Look, I got to tell you, that captures my experience with Straight Talk over the last year. My wife and I had a conversation last night. She looked at me and she said, a year ago today, did you think that the year would turn out like it did? Nope. No, not even close. Better, you know, on almost every count. Like, I'm really excited and I have purpose and I feel really good about it. Now, does that mean the answer found me or did I find it? I don't know, but here's what I did. I went for it. I just kept trying. I've kept innovating. I mean, I said to somebody yesterday, I've been pivoting enough lately, or at least it feels to me like I'm pivoting, that I feel like I'm on like a hamster wheel, not of pain, just a pivot. But you know, to the people I'm talking to, they're like, you're not really pivoting, you're refining, and gosh, we sure like it. Okay, cool. All right, I'll keep doing it. So I like some of this in terms of, you know, thinking about how to do some of this stuff and working through it differently. Let me pull in the third article then from Medium that we pulled. So it was the How I Burned $10 Million So You Don't Have To. Now, what's interesting is after I shared this, I saw some folks say, oh, this guy's an idiot. I mean, you know, you don't need to blow $10 million to do that. Okay. Sometimes we point these out. There was a line in here that I thought that was interesting, because one of the things that I'm finding more and more is the need for speed. That's whether you're in the enterprise, that's whether you're a startup. It's about that focus, right? So we just talked about, are you taking enough risk? Are you taking the right risks? Are you learning from the risks? Are you just getting out there and doing it? And so, like, we keep seeing these iterations. And, you know, I would say maybe over the last 5 years, it's been that whole fail fast, fail faster, right? And so now we're kind of backing up along this. But what I thought was really interesting on this was you can actually move too fast, right? So it's that understanding that, well, here's his quote. I now see it's not the speed of doing that matters. It's the speed of learning. And to learn, you frequently must slow down. To me, that's the money quote. That totally unlocked it. Yeah, it's the speed with which you can process and act and do stuff. Now, that leads itself into how much attention residue is clouding you, and are you busy versus productive, and are you focused versus interrupted all the time? But wow, like, the rest of it was all nice. But to me, that was, for a startup, that's the important part for me.
Oh, and remind me, Michael, I have something to tell you after the show, sort of along those lines. Make sure you remind me. So I'll keep you in on the edge of your seat.
I'm wait.
So I like this, How I Burned $10 Million So You Don't Have To. That's just a great title for the article.
Yeah, I mean it, you know, if you're trying to do clickbait, I think it works out really well. And it works, and that's good. Some of the other ones that I put in here that we get the chance to talk about, the Silicon Hills lawyer, that was a new one to me, but I'm going to start following it. You know, it was on this program that I really started to get this concept of technical debt, and I started to get it figured out. So then I pull this up talking about promising equity versus issuing equity, and then it talks about legal technical debt right off the top. I went, okay, this is really kind of cool. What's interesting is I've had some conversations with people recently where some of them don't necessarily appreciate what a lawyer can or can't do for them, because there's just some of that misunderstanding. But the quote here that stuck out to me is, The 10x cleanup cost of legal technical debt relative to what it would have cost to do it correctly from the start is often brutally painful. Yep. I mean, that to me was just like, wow, yeah, the way you structure it. By the way, if you've ever tried to do your own chart of accounts using QuickBooks or something like that and haven't thought about it, I find that's also brutal. I mean, mostly people just do journal entries now and they adjust it. But if you want to get right, that takes a little bit of time. I think the lesson in that, and we just heard this from Josh and Chris, is find experts that are good at what they do and let them be good at it. And then you do what you're good at so that you can kind of figure it out.
This is my free business advice for the day. When you have a business, the first people you should have kind of on your payroll as consultants or whatever is a really good lawyer. And depending on your business, maybe two or more different types of lawyers, right? And you should have a really good accountant.
Yeah.
And I mean, they don't need to be on your payroll, right? Because if you're just say you're a single, excuse me, person business, you need a really good accountant, you need a really good lawyer. And you hope that you never really need to pay your really good lawyer a lot of money, but just in case, you do need a good lawyer.
Yeah, right. Those are things that are always tougher to find under stress or later, right? So we talk about risks and risk taking and everything else. Now, here's the rest of what I thought this was good with. It was looking at equity and promising equity versus issuing equity. And it really laid out a lot of stuff. So this was like more of those, if you find yourself in that situation or you're asking those questions or you're going to go join a company and they're promising you equity, this has got a list of really solid questions, most of which I would not have thought about until I had read this. So I wanted to just at least put that out there and share it out there to say, yeah, there's some stuff here to think about. And, you know, I found a new source to take a look at. Now, this other one, Paul, I was thinking of you when I grabbed it. So this is the one on HuffPo. Five technologies your business should adopt right now.
Yes. I love this and I hate this. So go ahead.
Well, the number one reason, appointment scheduling software. You and I have talked about this.
That's huge. I agree.
I'm a lover of Calendly. In fact, my world got rocked this week by them in a really positive way. They now have a GoToMeeting, GoToWebinar integration. And this is what I had always wanted. So instead of, if you use that software, this is what I use when I do my coaching calls. This is what I use in the experience. So the way I had to set it up was I just had like the generic, hey, call me here, good to go, which means anybody could jump in at that time, right? There's not that I was terribly worried about privacy, but it was kind of just whatever. Now it's integrated. They have a beta integration. Mm-hmm. They let me into the beta. I've been using it all week. It's so freaking awesome. Everything shows up. I'm very happy with Calendly. And so I looked at this and I went, huh. Now, I looked at it, so I want your take on this, but also when I read stuff like this, and this is why I love doing this program and thinking about it, five technologies your business should adopt right now. Cool. Which also then means these might be areas to invest in if you're an investor. These are areas that if you're the buyer, are you looking at these things? Have you considered it? And I brought that up because Paul and I have and are. But also if you're a startup, if these are areas people telling you should do, go take a look at what's out there. See if you like it. See if it works. This might be an area where some attention makes sense. And of course, security's on it. So what was your impression?
Well, I think I like how, you know, these are technologies your business should adopt. I think it applies to startups. It applies to the entrepreneurs that are listening to this show, whatever you're doing, some work on the side or whatever. So if you take them in order, right, digital payment forms. Yeah, if you're selling widgets or whatever, that's important. I agree. I'll expand that into you should have some kind of, as we were mentioning before, accounting software, right? FreshBooks is a really nice way to get into something really easily. QuickBooks is a little more advanced for some of your more advanced businesses and what have you. And both of those also allow digital payment forms, right? You can accept bank transfers. You can accept credit cards. Those technologies are extremely important for a business. Information security, I mean, we have whole shows about that, including this one. So we'll just kind of skip that one for now.
Well, no, you know what, though? Let's not skip it, though, because here's the thing that I noticed about this, and I want to point out that I don't think this is – there's a couple points here. So we're saying these are technologies that your business should adapt. Security is not a technology,
no,
right?
No, you're right. That's a good point.
It's a process. And then it goes right into, and there's people that are victims of identity theft. Blah, blah. Okay, stop. If this is one of the only times you see us, breach is a symptom. It could be a symptom that you didn't think about security, blah, blah, blah. But listen, I'm not just worried about how you're handling that stuff. Think about your information. Think about what somebody could do if they could get to it. You know, I think I maybe put it in our show notes. I was invited to keynote an innovation conference, and we're going to talk about Straight Talk. And they asked me if I could do some talk about security. And I said, sure, let's talk about two things. Let's talk about innovation and security and where I'd love to see some startups and where I think, right? Because, I mean, Paul, we cover it. I ought to be able to talk about it. But then I also said, you know what? Let's go talk about the startups and this concept I've kicked around with you over the last year or two called minimum viable security, but more at a conversation level. So all I looked at here was to say, okay, let's take a look at it. But then it says, consider hiring a data security consultant to review your website for possible security breach. Yeah, listen, this is maybe something you and I should do a show on at some point.
Yeah.
How do you figure out who to trust in security? I mean, in talking about reviewing your website versus looking at your online payment form versus looking at your customer database, those are different skill sets. Yeah. So hold on. So anyway, good list. But so yeah, let's go ahead and skip over their recommendations for security, but say it's probably a good idea. And I'll tell you what, if you got questions, hit us up. You can shoot us on Twitter. You can send us an email. Let us know what questions you have or what suggestions you have, and we'll share that with everybody else.
The next one, the remote workers, is the one I really have an issue with, because I don't think that's necessarily for everyone in every position that you have in your company. And I think that is really on a case-by-case basis. It depends on the culture of your company, what your company is doing, what your startup is doing. And there are pluses and minuses to having remote workers there's not too many minuses to having everyone working in the same building unless you drive each other nuts, right? Or you're trying to attract talent that you can get remotely that you can't get in the local area. I think there's a lot more to the remote workers than is alluded to in this article. I don't think it's for everyone in every position is what I'm saying. I think there are advantages to startups having remote workers, any business having remote workers, but there's also some really heavy advantages, especially in startup mode, to having everyone all in the same building. And I've had to realize those over time, where I worked in security, and it really lends itself to working remotely for certainly in my career path and a lot of other career paths in security. Remote workers are great. You know, you think of a penetration tester or security researcher, fits really well. But if you've got a startup or you're doing some other kind of positions, there's a lot of great advantages to having everyone all in the same room. Now, that can be difficult depending on your geographic location. So that one I didn't necessarily agree with.
What's your take on the live chat for customer service? Is that something that you use? Do you like it? And would you want it to be synchronous?
I wouldn't be as specific as to say live chat. I would say that you need technology to enhance your customer service. And whether that's live chat or we talked about System 76 having that great ticketing system.
Yeah, I was going to bring that
up. Yeah, I don't think they need a live chat because they built such an awesome ticketing system. It's almost like a live chat was built in, but it's not live chat. So I don't necessarily think you should laser focus on live chat. You need awesome customer service, and you absolutely need technology to help you get there and choose your technologies wisely.
Yeah, I mean, if we're fair about it, I think too, this is a little bit of know your customer base, because you know, it's fascinating. There are some companies that I would prefer to just pick up the phone and call, because I know that either the complexity of it or whatever, I want that, or their experience is so good, I really enjoy it. And sometimes I want the chat, and because it's quicker, it's easier, I can do it asynchronously, and I don't want to tie up time on the phone. And I'll tell you one where I've done both is Google. Mm-hmm. When you do the Google apps, or what we call it now, G Suite. And it's a paid thing, I've actually initiated some stuff on the chat where they're like, hey, you know what, let's set up a call. And the calls have been great. Mm-hmm. And I've done some stuff where I called, and that was also great. Now, and they've actually been really good at following up. So I've been kind of pleasantly surprised.
That leads to an interesting segue into the technology that I'm looking for. And the Front app was a company that I have high hopes for. and I hope to circle back around with them. But I track a lot of activities in email, in Facebook, in Twitter, and in LinkedIn. And I want something that can consolidate all of those communications and let a team help respond to those to develop the business and tie into other activities as a team. I don't know, Michael, of any technologies other than Front that are working to do that. If people do, please let us know. We'll test them. And if they work, we'll bring some people from that company on the show, because that's something I've asked a lot of people about. And I don't hear a lot of people say, oh, yeah, you want this company or this technology. So,
no, that's good. You know, and this is too where, you know, you mentioned some of the plans that we have coming up for the program in the new year, right? We're talking to more investors. We've had great conversations with founders of companies. I loved Chris's perspective today as a guy who could tell us what it was like on the other side to get traction or to get somebody in. There's some stuff there I'm going to go replay and unpack and think about. So, you know, I would love to talk to some folks in the enterprise. If you're the person who's buying some of this technology or interested in it, tell us some of the challenges that you're solving. I mean, clearly, between all the programs that we do together and the writing that we do, we like to think that we're covering it all, but maybe not. So let's talk about some of those things and highlight them and put them out. And so, you know, we're going to keep putting stuff up like this and talking about it. And then, of course, all of these have security considerations and stuff. So I thought it was interesting. All right, here's another one I put up. Deal breakers, red flags from top VCs. So the thing that I liked about this list, I mean, it's salacious in its title, right? These are the things that we look for. If you're doing this, deal's off, right? And it's one of the ones I think, let's see, if it wasn't here, it was someplace else. It was like, you know, do you clear your own plates, you know, or how do you handle this? And what it's really saying is, here's how we evaluate people in the deal, right? It's not always the deal. Like sometimes in the startup world, we look at it and we think it's all about deal mechanics. It's all about, do the numbers look good on the spreadsheet? And every time I talk to investors, angel from seed money startup all the way up to the institutional investors, no, they want to know about the team. They want to know about your vision. They want to know about your reputation and your ability to deliver. So what I thought was interesting on this were a couple things. And the two that I thought were most fascinating, the two on the top really caught my attention. You send someone else to do your meeting with the investors. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a bad idea. And then the second
one, when founders take more than 48 hours to respond to emails. And I look at that. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, if this is important to you, it's got to be you. And you got to be the one doing it. Now, in fairness, what we've seen in the security world a lot is people in positions of leadership will have somebody else carry some of their water for them. And we think it's getting us an advantage. Well, they're better suited at it. They know the language. They can get the leverage. Yeah, it's ceding your authority. And this is saying the same thing here. If it's important to you, do it. If you're terrified of it, more reason to do it. Go get some coaching on it. Learn how to do it. But do it anyway. The rest of this I thought was interesting. You know, some of these things were interesting in terms of the way that you and I talk about some of it. You know, whether you know your industry or not, whether you're grounded in reality or not. I mean, goodness, we've got to bring up our obligatory Shark Tank thing. But, you know, how big is your market? The world. There's like almost 8 billion people. No, dude, that's not your market. Like, stop, you know.
Yeah, there's like a theme on a lot of these. Like, it's basically like not being wishy-washy, right? You got to know your direction, and you got to have just a clear path when you go through and do your pitch and you're running a business or a startup. You can't be kind of wandering on any of these issues that investors are asking you about. And I think that is where a lot of these articles that tell you about pitches and a lot of where people get in trouble on Shark Tank is when they're kind of, you know, wandering or thinking out loud about I think my target market is, it could be this or it could be that. And like, nope, done. You're done. You know, and having those hard numbers about your financials. There was another one in here. If the pitch, the founder is trying to convince him or herself of things, right? And I tend to now notice this in other conversations with people, if they don't have like a very clear direction in what their goals are or what the problem they're trying to solve or in any of these other areas, I'm like, oh, red flag.
Yep. I mean, look, some of this, I've certainly caught myself doing some of these things. But look, what I liked it as a list, right? So it's one of those things that gives you a peer into how it works. But then I said, you know, how much of this are you doing? How much of this are you doing yourself? I think it's a good gut check. So if you if you think you want to go, in fact, don't worry about raising money. If you think that you want to go get that first big customer, or you want to go build your first five customers, run through this list and see how many of these you might be doing without thinking about it. Because I think addressing them, or at least being aware of them, might offer you a slightly better better way at it. So anyway, those are some of the stories for the week. As we've started to do more and more, and I'm trying now to put a little bit more of a lens on this, but and for this week I called it Startup and Security Notes. So I saw three things that Owler, even the Optiv thing, Owler is the one. I tell you, Paul, it was a great find on your part.
It's awesome. It wasn't me. It was actually a coworker at my previous job, Liz, that turned me on to Owler.
Well, it's been fantastic. All right, so here's the things that I saw, and I wanted your take on a couple of them, and I just wanted to put them out there so people could track it. So there's SecDo. They develop a cybersecurity platform that offers contextual investigation, alerts validation, and response remediation services for organizations. So basically, I don't know what they actually do, but they raised a $10 million Series A round. And what I thought was interesting about that was for a Series A, that's on the large side, right? We're tending to see right now most Series A are $3 to $5 to $8 million. Some people will tell me it's 5 to 10, but I don't see a ton, right? Five tends to be. So Series A, 10 million is pretty good. And then if you go and you look at their competitors, it's CrowdStrike, it's Cyber Reason, it's SentinelOne, Bromium, right? So these aren't small companies in a somewhat crowded space. And so I was just kind of curious your general take on it.
I don't know if I have an opinion either way on that. I'm not familiar with the company. I think it is.
Yeah, it was new to me.
I think it is a big A round. So hopefully they're on to something good. I love new companies that are solving problems, and I like the scrappy ones that are going against bigger competition. I think that's great.
Yeah, I like it too. And so I thought it was interesting. By the way, I was also noting there's a lot of deals happening in the, you know, we're in the last month of the year, Q4. So everybody telling us, oh, the deal flows off. Oh, it's not. Yeah, well, I don't know. There's a lot going on right now. I thought that was interesting. So same thing. Here's another one that came out. Kenna Security Risk Intelligence Vulnerability Management Platform enables organizations to measure and monitor security services. They are a $15 million Series B. Okay, that sounds about right. But again, here's the thing that I think is interesting. So I looked at them when this popped up. So like, you know, and there's probably more that came in. So they're competing against Cloud Passage. They're competing against Tripwire.
Really.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I want to talk to you about. I looked at it and went,
no, what? You know, the competition that's listed on Owler is not always very accurate. Kenna was formerly Risk.io. So they compete with like RiskSense and a bunch of other companies that basically take in vulnerability data from multiple different sources and allow you, I mean, they say they contextualize it, but many of them, I think where their struggle is up to the user to help in a huge way to contextualize it. And there's a lot of work on the end user to do that. And everyone's program is so customized. Where I've seen, in fact, these type of companies get displaced is organizations, larger ones in any case, develop their own process to contextualize vulnerability and patch management type information. So,
does this round surprise you? Does it look good? Because I
mean, they must be doing something right if they did get if they're still around and got a $15 million Series B. Because I even with the limitations I just spoke of, it's a big problem in the industry. So they're obviously able to help clients with this issue. So they are competing against the big vulnerability management vendors as well, who try and include this functionality in the product, but often is not customizable enough for folks, which is why they'll look at something like a Kenna.
That's good insight. All right, last one of the week that I thought was interesting, not so much on the startup face, but still big. So Optiv, right, so Optiv was Accuvant and Fishnet, mm-hmm. and they came together and formed like a super company, and it looked to a certain extent to be like, hey, we're going to form the new security super company, and you don't just have to go to a big four, we're going to be able to do all these types of things. And, you know, from all accounts, it's been pretty successful. Then they announced about a month ago, okay, we're going to file for an IPO. And then this week it was, by the way, we just got acquired by KKR, which means Blackstone sold their majority stake but retained a minority stake. And now KKR has them. And OPS, the IPO is canceled. I just find that fascinating. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but like it's like if we go look at exits, typically your exit is either you IPO or you get acquired. And the way that this all came about was Blackstone, who has a pretty extensive security portfolio themselves, got two companies and mashed them together and then said, hey, now we're going to go build something big. So the IPO was logical. That made sense. All of a sudden, it's KKR. So then I dug into that and it was like, oh, wait, KKR has Darktrace, Ping, and Silence. So that's interesting. So I wish I had more insights to be able to say, well, no, that's really rare or that's really big or whatever. So if you do, shoot us a note. Let us know. Let us know what you think of it. But the thing I'm starting to notice now, and we're going to talk more about this in the coming year, is how do you size these investments and what's happening in the venture space and the institutional space? So a lot of times when we look at the startups, we're talking about the small startups and we're looking at pre-Series A or just got their Series A. And there's a lot of great stuff there and a lot we're going to keep looking at. But I've started to notice now too that some of the more traditional places have their own venture fund set up focusing on cyber. They're building portfolios. They're stacking companies. They're looking at the synergies. I know that's a word we should all drink to, but they're doing a lot of that. And so we're going to keep calling it out as we see it, because I think it's worth paying attention to.
I think it's interesting. some of the feedback and issues that I see with large MSSPs, you know, we saw SecureWorks go through a lot of rigmarole with, you know, IPO, not IPO, acquisition. Well, Dell acquisition, then spun off into IPO. And I find it interesting. I think what's frustrating for customers that want to use MSSPs is when you get feedback from other people who are using the same MSSPs, it's like 50-50 split. Half of them say, hey, our experience is great. And the other half are like, our experience is crappy. And I think that's because as an MSSP grows, they take on really large customers. They build specific teams to handle just those customers and give those customers great customer service. And then the other half of their customers are suffering on the customer service side and aren't getting what they need. So it's tough to navigate and figure out who the best MSSP is for you because of those issues. And on the back end of it, there's acquisitions, mergers, and IPOs that are complicating the culture and business processes to these large MSSPs, also putting that struggle on them as well.
Yeah, and you know, and you're right. And so if you look at SecureWorks and you look at, you know, going all the way back to the days of Lurk and everything else, what's going to be interesting then too is that I think the space is still pretty volatile. And what we're going to start seeing now is portfolios focusing on it. We're going to start seeing investment money trying to figure it out. And it's all going to be interesting. So it's an exciting time for us. In terms of our startup grind and some of the stuff that we're working on, you know, some of the big things for me this week is I'm having more conversations and I have finally gotten back to my own routine of publishing and writing. And I would invite people to check it out. I'm trying to answer questions actually now. And I'm following a strategy where I'm putting it out on my website and then I'm also sharing it on LinkedIn. So if we're already connected, I would love a thumbs up and a like and a share if you liked it. And if you didn't, let me know why or what I can do better. What's also kind of cool for me, Paul, is that even though I said I'm doing all these pivots, I'm starting out to figure things out a lot better. People have really helped me through these conversations. One of the things we talked about in an early show was you got to go out and have 20, 25 conversations. I'm still engaging in those conversations, but wow, the language is changing. The excitement is changing. I'm having great calls, and that's helping me see both what people need and what they like, and I'm able to do more of it. So I'm excited. I will say one of the things I wrote about this week, and I just want to touch on it real quick. A lot of people have said, well, no, man, I like what you're doing with Straight Talk, Michael, but you know, I don't think the people around me are ready for it. That's not Straight Talk. If you think that the people around you aren't ready because it's going to be a little brash or you're going to have to set them up right and tell them how it is, that's rude. That's not Straight Talk. Straight Talk actually acknowledges with the other people who they are, what they need, and you're using empathy to make it accessible and understandable to them, and then you're working together to get where you need to go. So I wrote about it, and I put it out there a little bit to try to define it a little bit better, and I'm going to keep doing stuff like that and work with people, so I'm kind of excited about that. How about you, Paul?
We are in the initial stages of getting our cloud platform going, which is very, very exciting. It's, you know, it's a lot of work. Initially, it's a lot of like paperwork, business type stuff. And, you know, that stuff has to get done to enable you to move forward and take care of our initial customers, which is very exciting as we get those as well. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're back again next week with more stuff and goodness to share with everybody.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening and watching this edition of Startup Security Weekly. See everyone next week.